150 years after the department's founding, battling extremist attacks on our democratic institutions also remains central to the department's mission.
The department Judge Merrick Garland refers to there is the Department of Justice. The extremists he talks about are domestic terrorists. On Monday, in his Senate confirmation hearing, Garland vowed that domestic terrorism would be his first priority if confirmed as Attorney General, and that he would, quote, do everything in the power of the Justice Department to stop it.
From 1995 to 1997, I supervised the prosecution of the perpetrators of the bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building, who sought to spark a revolution that would topple the federal government. If confirmed, I will supervise the prosecution of white supremacists and others who stormed the Capitol on January 6th, a heinous attack that sought to disrupt a cornerstone of our democracy.
That was Monday of this week. On Tuesday, former Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund testified to a Senate committee about the terror his officers experienced during the January 6th attack on Congress.
I've been in policing for almost 30 years. The events I witnessed on January 6th was the worst attack on law enforcement and our democracy that I've seen in my entire career. I witnessed insurgents beating police officers with fists, pipes, sticks, bats, metal barricades, and flagpoles. These criminals came prepared for war.
On Wednesday, in a House hearing, Texas Congresswoman Veronica Escobar called on her colleagues to do more to understand a rising threat.
We've got to understand, number one, the root causes that fuel the violence. Number two, the tools that are used by domestic terrorists in order to inflict that violence.
So, for much of the week, the threat of domestic terrorism was front and center on Capitol Hill. A profound change in focus, away from America's international anti-terrorism effort, begun by President George W. Bush following the attacks of September 11, 2001.
Make no mistake about it. Underneath our tears is the strong determination of America to win this war. And we will win it.
20 years and trillions of dollars later, even the Department of Homeland Security, created after 9/11, is pivoting toward homegrown terrorism. In an October 2020 annual threat assessment, DHS called domestic terrorism, quote, the most persistent and lethal threat in the homeland. But what form does that threat take? What constitutes an act of domestic terrorism? Well, it has been 2 months and a day since Anthony Quinn Warner died by suicide while exploding a massive truck bomb in Nashville, Tennessee. He destroyed several city blocks on Christmas Day 2020. Adam Tamburin, investigative reporter at the Tennessean, says officials still aren't clear on what to call the act.
I think this is a case that really shows how complicated this word terrorism is and all the legal kind of webs that are behind that word and the emotional connections people have with that word. So law enforcement has not called this an act of terror at this point because there is not evidence yet that we know of that this was connected to a political message or ideology. Whether or not we call this terrorism, there's no doubt it was a terrifying experience for the people who were there.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Today, after 2 decades of fighting international terrorism in that war on terrorism, the United States is turning its attention home. So what will a battle against domestic terrorism look like? And what exactly are we fighting against? Well, Abigail Spanberger is a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. She represents Virginia's 7th Congressional District. From 2006 to 2014, she served as a CIA case officer working overseas on classified national security and terrorism matters. Representative Spanberger, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me, Meghna.
Also with us today is Elizabeth Newman. She's a former senior advisor and deputy chief of staff at the Department of Homeland Security. Prior to that, she served as assistant secretary for counterterrorism at DHS. Now she is director at the Republican Accountability Project. Elizabeth Newman, welcome to you.
Thank you, Meghna. It's great to be with you.
So, Representative Spanberger, let me just start with you. How would you describe sort of the nature of the conversation right now on Capitol Hill regarding the threat of domestic terrorism?
Well, the conversation on Capitol Hill is an interesting one because, of course, we saw up close and personal a terrorist attack on the United States Capitol. We were in the process of finalizing the results of the election, a constitutional duty that we as members of Congress have, when that attack occurred. And it's broadly known that that attack occurred by those who wanted to disrupt that day and that duty. And so on Capitol Hill, the conversations are starting at various points. Some of it is still trying to understand the attacks of January 6th and what actually occurred. Some people are talking about, legislatively speaking, what is it we need to do next? Some people are talking about how do we understand this threat? How did it come to be? How did it grow so deep that we would see this attack on January 6th? And frankly, I think all of those conversations are very, very important because it is a process. We have to understand the scope of this threat, where it comes from, where the ideology has taken root, how it has taken root, before we can begin to see a process by which we can, fully thwart it. And so, the conversations are ongoing, and I think we should expect to see that for, unfortunately, years into the future as we contend with the threat of domestic terrorism.
So, Elizabeth Newman, there's a lot to discuss here. And let's just take something that Representative Spanberger just said. Do we even understand the scope of the threat right now?
I think the lack of preparation on January 6th tells us that we don't. There have been people raising the alarm over the last 10 years, in particular over the last 3 or 4 years, about this growth of violent white supremacy, a growth of violent anti-government extremism, primarily in the form of militias, private militias, which are illegal in all 50 states, but a lot of misinformation out there about what they are. And for some reason, and when I was in government, I would often get briefed that while these groups do pose a threat, they are very disorganized. They tend to attract adherents that don't get along with one another and therefore can't seem to get their act together to ever do something of a coordinated nature the way that Al-Qaeda could with 9/11. And it almost created this complacency that what you're dealing with are largely just, disaffected individuals that love to have their grievances. They shout a bunch of rhetoric online. Occasionally, it spills over into something that might be considered a local or a state law enforcement concern. But there wasn't quite the attention to it that it really deserved until you saw around 2018, 2019, DHS and then FBI followed suit to say, hey, the threat from violent white supremacists is on par with what we're seeing out of ISIS. Mm-hmm. But even then, mm-hmm. that didn't seem to change the posture of how to interpret all of the warning signs we were seeing leading up to January 6th.
So, Representative Spanberger, do you care to posit about why it didn't change the posture of the national security establishment?
Well, and going back, kind of taking off my congressional hat and putting back on my former intel hat, and I, as a CIA officer, I worked foreign-based terrorism cases. That was what I was focused on. And so looking at how we viewed the networks, how we assessed the challenges as an ideology drew people from different places and different countries and different backgrounds to this same sort of mission, if you could call it that, of destruction, defined slightly differently with Al-Qaeda, defined slightly differently with ISIS. I think that, and I agree with what Elizabeth was saying, that Because of the seemingly haphazard nature, or at least the willingness to believe that there was a sort of haphazard nature of the formation of these groups across the country, that they weren't going to be as organized. And so I think that the point that Elizabeth just made is a very good one, that looking at these groups sort of independently, there wasn't this broad concern related to their ability to organize, their ability to be driven by a singular focus, the way that, you know, we've broadly seen and accepted and worried about, be it ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, any of the other international terrorist organizations. I think there has also been a level of complacency, because when we have seen acts of aggression, and I'll point to the engagement at the Capitol in Michigan, where mm-hmm. we saw militia groups armed to the teeth, screaming in the faces of police, and which was broadly offensive to many people, it didn't cross that line of actual physical violence. And so I think that as there have been incidents like that, that has allowed people to continue with a level of complacency of, yes, we know it's a problem, but it hasn't crossed a line. Meanwhile, arguably, we've seen Charlottesville, we've seen, you know, defacing of Jewish cemeteries, we've seen the murders at the Tree of Life Synagogue. There have been other clear evidence of it crossing a violent and murderous line. But because of some of those more notable examples that kind of offended our senses, but didn't present the same way that a foreign extremist and foreign terrorist organization had, that we were able to lull, the people were able to lull into that sense of complacency.
Well, so Representative Spanberger and Elizabeth Newman, just hang on here for a second. We have to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk more about defining what that line is. I mean, that's really the big question here in terms of how the country takes steps in reducing the potential for domestic terrorism, and if it should take any steps at all. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In this hour, we are talking about domestic terrorism in the United States and what, if anything, needs to be done at the level of legislation, at the level of prevention, in terms of what the Department of Homeland Security calls the most lethal threat to the United States right now. I'm joined today by Elizabeth Newman. She's director of the Republican Accountability Project and former senior advisor and deputy chief of staff at the Department of Homeland Security. Representative Abigail Spanberger joins us as well. She's a Democrat representing Virginia's 7th District. Okay, so Representative Spanberger, let me stick with you here for a second, because you talked about discussions on Capitol Hill regarding legislation. Now, first and foremost, to be clear, there is no specifically statutory defined thing called domestic terrorism, whereas there is a statutory definition of international terrorism. Some people see that as a yawning gap. Do you think that gap needs to be filled by legislation?
Well, and so I think it's important to note that there's a definition of it, but it's not a definition of a crime, right? So we understand that domestic terrorism is a, you know, a dangerous act to intimidate a civilian population, to influence policy, etc. But that in and of itself is not a crime to be prosecuted.
Well, so just because you make a good point, so let me just read out what that statutory definition is. You're right to clarify. There is a definition, but it's not an official federal crime as international terrorism is. But that statutory definition is U.S. Code Chapter 18, it is acts within the United States that are dangerous to human life or violate the laws of the U.S. or a state and, quote, appear to be intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population, to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion, or affect the conduct of a government by mass destruction, assassination, or kidnapping. Is that adequate?
Well, so that's just the definition, right? Like, that helps give clarity to why January 6th is something that I readily and easily feel comfortable calling a terrorist attack. It is it is why other events that may not fall into that category. But the difference here is, if you are an international terrorist, right, if you are joined or linked up with Al-Qaeda, whether you live in the United States or if you're overseas, just being linked to that terrorist organization, if you give material support, if you send them money, if you help them in the acts that they are executing someplace in the world, that becomes a criminal offense. And so the challenge from an investigatory standpoint, and certainly I would love Elizabeth's perspective, having worked so much with the Department of Homeland Security, from an investigatory standpoint, that makes it very difficult to do some of those initial investigations. But the challenge, I think, from a legal standpoint, and as a legislator, you know, my focus is, how do we ensure that if we are creating tools for federal investigators to be able to define out domestic terrorist organizations, to define out acts of domestic terrorism, so that we can say who's providing them support, who's helping their execution of a violent attack, or even who is bringing people to the fold, we very quickly get into real challenging conversations about someone's First Amendment right to say something that might be offensive, that might be unacceptable to our combined view, but is protected speech. And so, you know, that's among the conversations we're having on Capitol Hill, is how do we ensure that we can get at the heart of this threat and still ensure that we are completely and totally protecting our First Amendment rights and our values as Americans.
Yeah. So Elizabeth Newman, I'm going to come to you in just a quick second. But Representative Spanberger, just for the sake of clarity, though, I mean, there are many people who say the national security establishment already has vast tools, or actually, let's even put it this way. The domestic law enforcement in the United States, the DOJ on down, already has vast tools. But why do we need that? They would say, therefore, we don't need any more specific legislation defining domestic terrorism as a crime. The tools are already there. What do you think about that?
Also, I think the tools for investigating criminal offenses are there. Absolutely. It depends on if someone wants to make the argument of how it is that we're following and linking these foreign terrorist networks, right? So I have heard recently a lot of people saying, well, we do it with Al-Qaeda, we do it with ISIS. No, why aren't we doing it with these domestic terrorist organizations or domestic violent extremist organizations? And part of the challenge here is because there are criminal statutes that allow for federal investigators to do that link analysis, to charge someone with material support to terrorism, which is just not something with even just being a member of Al-Qaeda or ISIS, right? And that doesn't exist in the domestic space. And there's a variety of legislative proposals that we have before Congress right now. My colleague, Representative Schneider, has one that would just authorize domestic terrorism organizations within DHS and the Department of Justice and FBI to analyze and monitor domestic terrorist activity and require the federal government take steps to prevent domestic terrorist activity. And so this is an issue of provision of resources and training, establishment of interagency task force, and directing DOJ to offer support to communities where there may be nexuses to domestic terrorism. And so, you know, there are proposals out there that would pivot attention to the threat of domestic terrorism without necessarily applying the same sort of legal standard, or without creating the same sort of permissible right. tools to investigate them as exist with foreign terrorism.
Okay, so Elizabeth Newman, go ahead. Let me ask you though. I think let's just get straight to one of the primary concerns here, and Congresswoman Spanberger did touch on this. The Constitution, right? And the idea that decisions have to be made in terms of if a criminal definition is going to be applied to domestic terrorism about, we're talking about gathering, we're talking about speech, we're talking about thoughts and beliefs. What many civil libertarians, people on both sides of the aisle are pointing to is that A, yes, there are civil liberties issues, but B, more importantly, again, the national security establishment in the United States already has so many tools available to them that why are those not sufficient right now? I mean, just what's your thought on that? Are they sufficient or not?
So whether it's a civil libertarian or a member of a marginalized community speaks out expressing concern about more authorities, I definitely want to listen. We need mm-hmm. to learn from our successes as well as our mistakes over the last 20 years. And as the Congresswoman can probably speak to, we made mistakes. There yes. are more terrorists today than there were in 9/11. I mean, yes, we've prevented another 9/11 from happening. So that's a huge accomplishment. But if we still have more terrorists today than we did 20 years ago, maybe we aren't winning. Mm. We need to figure out how we reduce the spread of terrorism and reduce the number of people ascribing to that belief system, meaning that violence is justified for political aims. And we need to do that worldwide. And it just so happens that right now it's on our shores. So I think the answer is not to dismiss their concerns. They're expressing concerns based on mistakes that have been made for the last 20 years. We need to look at that and we need to learn from it. But I also don't think that that means that we don't do anything and we just keep the status quo, because the status quo is also not working. January 6th happened. Mm-hmm. We have white supremacists large numbers, but we know that there is infiltration in the military and in our law enforcement services. We have to address this. Mm-hmm. I think the most compelling argument that I've heard is that part of the problem is that we're not adhering to equal justice under the law, in my mind means we need to treat threats from ideologies that originated overseas and within the U.S. Mm-hmm. the same. One of the big misnomers, we call violent white supremacy and anti-government militias domestic terrorist threats. But those are actually very global ideologies. There is interaction between people here in the United States and Western Europe and Australia and other parts of the globe, building and adding to and encouraging the spread of these ideologies. So one thing that makes it challenging is because we in the United States are the exporters of it, if you will. And that's not to say that there aren't other parts of the globe that also export, but it makes it harder for us to figure out how to frame this global threat, this global violent extremism threat, is not something over there that we can just kind of say, okay, we're sending troops to Afghanistan, and now I can go mm-hmm. back to my normal life because, you know, somebody's taking care of the problem, they're going to keep us safe. No, the threat is actually here. But the law treats it differently. So you could take an individual. They could plan an activity that is criminal in nature. And if mm-hmm. they were doing it in the name of ISIS, the FBI would be able to investigate it in a slightly different way. They'd have more tools at their disposal. And when it came time to disrupt and charge that individual, they could charge them with a higher level, more serious crime than mm-hmm. the same act, the same person here in the United States doing it in the name of a neo-Nazi group. To me, that is not how the law should treat. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't treat somebody doing something in the name of ISIS differently than somebody doing something in the name of the neo-Nazis the same crime.
But can I just jump in here? So you can charge them with a higher level and more serious crime. Okay. But for mm-hmm. example, let's take the plot to kidnap Governor Whitmer as an example, that the FBI investigated those men, they interrupted the plot, they have been charged, including with some terrorism-related charges as well. And I'm presuming that many of those charges carry some pretty significant penalties. So here's a case where a potential act of domestic terrorism was actually thwarted without the without the need of those additional tools or higher-level criminal charges. Is that not enough, Elizabeth Newman?
I think that the FBI and the men and women in state and local law enforcement do a great job of using the tools that they have to go after the threats that they discover. So it's not, in my mind, a question that they can't do anything. But let me give you some counterexamples. There was an investigation into two Boogaloo Boys activities over the summer. And in the indictment, which became public in late August, early September, you discover that they, further along in their plotting, interacted with people that they thought represented Hamas, that they were going to Hamas to be able to further their plans. Now, it doesn't say that the FBI set them up, but many counterterrorism experts looked at that and said, aha, so you had to get creative in order to be able to disrupt this plot. And it is easier to disrupt things if we can find that tie to an international foreign terrorist organization. So there are examples like that. And when you talk to U.S. attorneys and law enforcement, you find that it makes their job more challenging. Now, I'm open to there being a debate that maybe the tools that we created post 9/11, maybe we need to change the way that they're being used. Yeah. Maybe that's the solution. But I don't think that you should treat people differently based on if they're doing something for Hamas versus a Boogaloo Boys.
So
if they're doing a crime, it needs to be treated equally.
I'm just going to jump in here and Representative Spanberger, I will come back to you in a second, but this is the perfect place to really bring in like the specific concerns that, for example, civil liberties lawyers have. Because Elizabeth Newman, you were talking about that the lack of certain tools makes law enforcement's job more difficult. But of course, folks like the ACLU would say, well, you know, after 9/11, it seemed like there was no concern about or no worry about not having enough tools because, you know, we had this immediate ballooning of the national security state over almost all Americans. I mean, we all remember when it was discovered that the government was secretly collecting metadata from people's phones from virtually every American following the passage of the U.S. Patriot Act. But we got a little bit more information about the civil liberties concerns here from Hina Shamsi and her concerns about what happens, those unintended consequences with new anti-terrorism legislation. And she is director of the ACLU's National Security Project.
What we see over and over again, the pattern that needs to be broken, is that the response to white supremacist violence cannot and must not be new laws that will harm the rights of communities of color, the First Amendment, due process, and equal treatment rights of all people under the Constitution.
Now, her group was formed after the attacks of September 11, 2001, and also in the wake of that massive expansion of the national security bureaucracy. And her team has focused and litigated many cases relating to national security and civil liberties.
When white supremacist violence escalates, politicians often look to give law enforcement agencies more power. And that's part of the warning that we should take into account.
Now, Shamsi says the pattern of unintended consequences actually long predates 9/11. In 1996, for example, following an earlier attack on New York's World Trade Center and following the Oklahoma City bombing, President Clinton signed the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. That law mandated deportation for legal permanent residents who'd been sentenced to a year or more for things like, quote, moral turpitude or controlled substances. Groups such as Human Rights Watch say the law authorized what is now widely used fast-track deportation procedures for what they believe are increasingly minor offenses. So Shamsi says the DOJ subsequently tried to amend that overreach, but the attempts only went so far.
Post 9/11, the Department of Justice and then later the Departments of Homeland Security issued internal guidance prohibiting bias-based profiling, recognizing it as ineffective and problematic, but had carve-outs for national and border security, which, given the nature in this country of who law enforcement has largely seen as a threat throughout history, Black and brown people, means that law enforcement agencies have targeted communities of color as threats, as domestic terrorism targets, and for overcriminalization and prosecution.
That's Hina Shamsi, director of the ACLU's National Security Project. And she strongly urges before any new anti-terrorism legislation is passed, that the first thing she believes should happen is that Congress should thoroughly investigate in a public way, a la the 9/11 investigations, what happened on January 6th. So Congresswoman Spanberger and Elizabeth Newman, I'll get your responses to that when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On Monday's show, we're going to be talking about the state of long-term care in the United States, specifically nursing homes, and what's been not just revealed by the COVID catastrophe, but what needs to be done to improve long-term care in the United States. So we want to hear your stories. Give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683 about your experience with long-term care, with nursing homes, and what do you think the country needs to do to fix the system. Today, we are talking about domestic terrorism in the United States and whether it's time for more legislation regarding domestic terrorism or actually better solutions that are further upstream. And I'm joined by Elizabeth Newman. She's director of the Republican Accountability Project and a former senior advisor and deputy chief of staff at the Department of Homeland Security. Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger also joins us. She's a Democrat representing Virginia's 7th District and a former case officer at the CIA. And Representative Spanberger, we heard Hina Shamsi there, director of the ACLU's mm-hmm. National Security Project, talking about what she sees as a pattern of unintended consequences befalling communities of color and immigrants in the United States with anti-terrorism legislation. But at the end there, she talked about maybe what initial first steps ought to be instead, a deep investigation into January 6th. And also, I wonder, Elizabeth Newman a little earlier was saying that, like, there's just a lot that we don't know, or she was sharing some things that I had no idea about potential connections, let's say, between extremist groups here. I know that Dick Durbin has called for legislation that would actually have regular detailed assessments of the domestic terrorism threat so that we'd actually have that information. Is that a better place to start here?
100%. 100%. And the reason it's a better place to start is we've talked about some of the challenges that law enforcement faces in investigating some of the differences, statutorily speaking, between acts of domestic violence or domestic terrorism and foreign-based terrorism. But at the root of all of it, I think our next step should not be trying to rectify that difference or trying to put them on parallel paths. The next steps we have to take is understanding what this threat is, and I would agree that I mean, as evidenced by what happened on January 6th, that there is so much that we don't know. There is so much information that still, even related to that one specific event, there is so much more information that keeps coming out day by day. And it's incredibly important that we understand the groups, the intent, how people join them, the focus towards a particular attack, be it January 6th, and also how our larger community and society has made it possible for the further real rooting in formation of more organized groups that could lead to a circumstance where we would see thousands of people on the front, you know, lawn of the United States Capitol, where, you know, then hundreds would actually invade the building. And that's really, truly an important piece of this. And I would argue it's also incredibly important that politics play absolutely no role in the threat assessment, in understanding what happened on January 6th, in understanding how it is that domestic violent extremist groups have been able to really put their roots in the ground, because it's incredibly important that we actually understand this threat. And so we need a comprehensive understanding, but politicians cannot undermine law enforcement or intelligence or any of the individuals who might be on a committee investigating what happened, because they may dislike the adherences or the kind of stated goals of particular extremist groups.
So, Elizabeth Newman, let me lean on your DHS experience here, because there's just a gap in my understanding. Because, early in the show, I referenced that October 2020 DHS threat assessment that identified white supremacist extremists as the most persistent and lethal threat to the homeland. So that conclusion didn't just come out of midair, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, is DHS, does it have more information than we know? I mean, are those assessments actually ongoing, but perhaps not making their way into, if not the public sphere, then at least the congressional sphere for appropriate oversight? I mean, help me understand that.
No, that's a great question. So, going back to those constitutional challenges, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I love our Constitution, but we cannot investigate what is happening inside our homeland quite the same way we can run intelligence operations and collection overseas. So there's already kind of a capabilities gap that's most likely always going to be there. I can't ever see us making significant changes. It would require constitutional amendments. So what you're left with is knowledge that's obtained through investigations that those are FBI led. And one of the most important things to realize is, you know, domestically speaking, when we talk about understanding threats and adversaries, the intelligence community is made up of 17 different agencies. And then the national security community also includes, you know, beyond the intelligence community, the DOD and the State Department, they're all this, all these large organizations. They're very outward focused. They're looking at what's going on around the world. And that creates this collective knowledge about our friends and our adversaries overseas. Domestically speaking, there really are only two agencies that have the statutory authority to be doing work inside the homeland. That's DOJ and DHS. And then, of course, as I just mentioned, they're kind of restrained in how they do that. So you already are narrowing the scope of the number of institutions that can look at things. And then largely the way that we do counterterrorism here in the United States is with and through our state and local partners, as well as private sector partners. So everything that we do to secure the homeland is done through that partnership structure. It is not DHS as the first preventer or DHS as the first responder. It's always equipping, empowering, informing our partners of to the best of our ability so that they can go and do the necessary work to secure. And then the last piece is, you know, at a certain types of threats do justify bringing in the FBI and their authorities to be able to investigate. And there are a number of law enforcement agencies that DHS has that contribute to those counterterrorism investigations. But the reason I lay all that out is to say the information that we can collect domestically is largely in the form of investigations. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I found as we started to notice a rise in attacks, anti-Semitic attacks in particular, and you started hearing from experts, not in the government, but outside experts like the ADL, you started to hear, like, we're seeing an uptick in hate crimes. We're seeing an uptick in these attacks. Something is happening. And so you would turn to the intelligence analysts and say, what is happening? And they couldn't tell you because they weren't looking at this through the traditional strategic intelligence lens of trends and, you know, tell us about certain types of groups and movements. They were looking at it through an investigation lens. And this has been a common challenge historically over the last 20 years. The FBI's job is to investigate and disrupt. It is not necessarily to produce strategic intelligence. DHS was supposed to fill that gap, but in order for DHS to do that, or we also have the National Counterterrorism Center, and their authorities allow for limited support in the domestic space. But in order for them to produce that strategic intelligence, they need access to data, which is FBI case file data. So it created this challenge, and it wasn't until, I would say, in the last year that analysts were able to start stitching together something of a strategic picture, which led to that Homeland Threat Assessment. But if you look underneath the hood, they still lack data, which is why you've seen movements on the Hill to try to increase the collection of data on these collecting hate crime statistics, for example. It would be extremely helpful if we could somehow force our state and local partners to collect that data and share it with us. But the other thing that the Biden administration did, I want to say it was second or third day in office, he signed an order to the DNI to do this assessment. And he told them to go talk to outside experts. That's hugely important because I found in leaving government, I had more time to go talk to those experts. I learned so much more from the people that are outside of government than the people that are inside government.
Well, so there's literally everything that both of you say. I have like 50 questions follow up. But unfortunately, we're running out of time. And there's a couple of really important things I do want to get to before I have to let both of you go. And one of them is that, you know, again, with this sort of the difficulty that we have in really defining isn't the right word, but talking about exactly what constitutes domestic terrorism, we're dealing with a big constellation of not just groups, but individuals, acts, potential acts, etc. There is a lot of sort of fog of war out there. And the reason why I mention that is because I have to talk about for a minute what happened in Nashville on Christmas Day in 2020.
Well, you know, in the news, Christmas is a day where nothing happens, right? So everybody, the entire newsroom was off. We might have had one person on hand to be there and just in case something happened. But my phone starts buzzing around 6 o'clock, and it's family members who are seeing the news and saying, "Hey, have you seen this? What's going on? There's smoke downtown. There's an explosion downtown."
Well, for the past 2 months and a day, Adam Tamburin, reporter for the Tennessean newspaper, has been investigating why Anthony Quinn Warner blew up two city blocks and himself in a massive truck bomb explosion. Warner was reportedly a reclusive person. However, he was on law enforcement's radar.
There had been this investigation in August 2019 into some allegations made against him by a girlfriend who said, "He's building bombs. He knows how to build bombs. He has explosives in his RV." And police, according to the records that we have, they did look into it. I think there's a lot of disagreement on whether or not they did enough to look into it. They went to his house. They saw the RV. They knocked on the door. He didn't answer. They made a couple other attempts to reach him. And they had the FBI run a check to make sure that there weren't any concerning things on his record. And then, you know, the tip went dormant for months.
Well, 16 months later, Warner drove his RV into downtown Nashville and detonated it. Several people were injured. 41 buildings were tremendously damaged. Communications and internet infrastructure were crippled across several states. But Warner's motives remain unknown. However, Adam Tamborin's sources expect the FBI to release a report soon. But he says, even in Nashville, though, there's disagreement over whether to call what happened an act of domestic terrorism.
On the one hand, you absolutely understand the people who say, well, this was, this terrorized a city. Of course it's terrorism. And then on the other hand, you have business owners standing in businesses that they spent their life savings on saying, whatever you call it, it's the effect is just as bad. And then if you call it terrorism, it might be even worse for me. That's all kind of come to a head in this area of Nashville that is so beloved, so historic, and so central to our economy and our identity as a city.
That's Adam Tamborin, investigative reporter for the Tennessean newspaper. Now, again, we don't really know yet definitively what the motivation was behind that bombing. But in the last 3 minutes that we have, Representative Spanberger and Elizabeth Newman, the Tennessee example makes me think that really shouldn't the area of perhaps greatest focus or new focus be as far upstream as possible. We've been talking about, you know, groups that are starting to organize or individuals that are potentially getting close to actually violent actions. But underlying all this are various ideologies, poisonous, dangerous ideologies. And sort of de-radicalizing or preventing the spread of those ideologies, isn't that the best way to fight domestic terror? Representative Spanberger.
Well, and I'll go quickly so that Elizabeth can chime in. But I think the last point that Elizabeth made was a very, very good one in laying the groundwork to answer this question, right? She mentioned that you've got 17 different intelligence community agencies, but you've got only DOJ and DHS who work what would be domestic terrorism. And so as a former CIA officer, I was a operational person, but our intel analysts would spend day and night tracking out these networks, tracking out what's driving people, tracking out the talking points, tracking out, you know, the links between who's talking to who and where and why, not only to get at where there might be an attack and who might lead that attack, but what's motivating it, how they're recruiting people, how they're bringing people into the fold. And so when we're talking about what's happening, you know, if we're talking about Al-Qaeda or ISIS, you know, if this had been that type of scenario, talking about the Tennessee bombing, if this man had been perhaps an adherent of those ideologies or had been trying to fall in and made contact with Al-Qaeda, you know, as a young man overseas, trying to fall in with a terrorist organization, that's something that through the gathering of intelligence, separate from and apart from an actual, you know, criminal act, people would have insight into that. They would see those networks. What brought him in? What was the effort to bring him into the fold? And to get at your question, that's the real challenge, right? And to Elizabeth's comment, looking at what's happening actually in think tanks and in research around domestic violent extremist groups and domestic terror groups is a real source of information, because that's not happening within the intelligence community. And arguably it should or it shouldn't. That's not the point. But how do you then get at, you know, what are the lies? What are the conspiracies? What are the motivations and the pulls, the calls to action?
Right.
You know, how is it? And to bring it to January 6th, what is this lie that happened for months and months that made people, gave them their call to arms to attack the Capitol? That has to be part of the larger investigation, be it of Tennessee, be it of January 6th, or any of these other events.
Well, unfortunately with that, Elizabeth Newman, we're out of time, because really, I'm also wondering how much harder this work is now that we know that some of those big lies, as Congresswoman Spanberger is talking about, are actually being advanced by members of Congress still to this day. But with that point, Representative Spanberger, Democrat from Virginia's 7th District, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth Newman, Director of the Republican Accountability Project and former senior advisor at the Department of Homeland Security. Sorry I couldn't give you the last word there, but thank you for being with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.